Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to yet another edition of ITE 1 Class 1. This is Chapter 4, and it is Preventive Maintenance and Troubleshooting.
Yay!
Yay indeed, what fun! Because, you know, in almost every IT job, troubleshooting is a really valuable skill to have. Because whether you're being a field technician and having to go out on site and fix someone's machine, or whether you're on a help desk, or whether you work in a corporate environment and someone rings up and says to you, I can't log on to the network, you're troubleshooting. So just about in every job that you're doing has got some, you're doing some kind of troubleshooting. So this chapter is all about that, but also about preventive maintenance, because we all pay a lot for our machines, whether we're home users or whether we're in a company, and they cost a hell of a lot. Especially for those of us on fixed incomes, they cost even more. So they're worth preserving and maintaining. Now, of course, with any skill, the more you use it, the better you get. Experienced techs mainly use their instincts. And if you're one of those, it might be easy to dismiss a chapter like this, yes, E, but even the most seasoned pro can miss...
We had a bit of fun with this chapter last year when I was instructing, because I'll wait for Kylie to get up to where she plugs the supplemental that Jackie and I did, and I'll have something to say on it.
We did indeed, and I'll do that at the end, because we don't have time to run a supplemental at the moment. There are more lectures going on now than there used to be at that time, so we have actually less time to do it. If we want to do it in the future, we'd have to mutually organise a time that's going to be convenient for everybody. But even the most seasoned pro can miss a vital and obvious steps. You hear stories of technicians working for hours on some problem that's just had a loose cable or something. So when you're experienced, sometimes you can miss the things that really seem obvious. It's so easy to overlook them. But what I'm hoping is the guidelines here will be for you about providing some kind of analysis of what you're actually doing when you troubleshoot, as well as a reminder to cover all the bases, as I said.
Can I just chime in with something on that now, if you're going to leave it to the last? The reason I want to is because there's a vast difference in the troubleshooting steps between the 4.0 curriculum and the 4.1 curriculum that Kylie's presenting now. So if you were to listen to the beginning of this lecture, and you shoot off now and get the lecture down from the supplemental one that Jackie and I did last year, and you hear a discrepancy between the however many troubleshooting steps there were then and there are now, that is why. Because all the Cisco people and the psychiatrists and psychic analyzers and people like that have gotten to it and put more steps in there.
Actually, it's less. They've been condensed down.
It's less, is it?
Names. Yes.
They've gotten reworded it all.
Yeah.
Righto. It is a little bit different. But don't fail your exam on the fact that you've listened to the wrong version of the lecture, that's all.
Yeah, just be aware that they're somewhat more sort of legalistic sounding, but I will translate, I promise, because they are a little bit more difficult on their own.
I just thought I'd put that in. Sorry, Kylie.
That's okay. That was going to be mentioned when we talked about the lab at the end, but I'm glad you mentioned it now. Now, okay, for those with less experience than the techs who use their instincts, I'm hoping these guidelines are a good starting point to developing the troubleshooting skill, because it is an important one. But before we get to that, we've got another important thing to look at, and that's preventive maintenance. We've covered some of this, and first of all, this is going to be a bit of a review for everybody. The purpose of preventive maintenance. Now, the notes say, and it's a good definition to remember because it's quite wordy, but it's very specific. Preventive maintenance is a regular and systematic inspection, cleaning, and replacement of worn parts, materials, and systems. Preventive maintenance helps to prevent failure of those parts, materials, and systems by ensuring that they are in good working condition. I have paraphrased this a bit because it's pretty verbose. Okay, how might we perform preventive maintenance on our hardware? This is the review part. Come on, hit me with it, people. What do we have to do to the hardware to make sure it stays in good condition?
Open the box and clean the fans and make sure there's no dust and dirt on the fans.
And what are we going to use to do that?
Probably just some air.
Excellent. Yep, that's one. There are actually five, I think, looking at this here. So what's another one?
Brush.
Brushing what?
The keyboard. Actually, not for inside the case.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. We've also got to take care of the outside of the case. So what do we do? How do we clean the outside of the computer case?
Well, they have those pre-moistened towelettes that you can safely use on your keyboard, monitor, and exterior of the case. And everything almost always seems to default to a lint-free rag.
Yeah, it does. But you can, if you don't want to go to the expense of having pre-moistened towelettes, you can just use a mild solution of dishwash detergent and water. That'll also do the same trick if you're a cheapskate like me. Okay, where else are we going to clean? We clean the keyboard and mouse here and outside of the case and inside. What else are we going to do on the outside of the case to just check that things are running as they should?
Like checking the cables to be sure that there's no wear and that they are inserted properly. I don't know if that's what you're referring to.
Yep, it is. That's excellent. Yeah, cables can work loose. They can wear. They can bend if they're in your way and you trip over them a bit, or you have to keep moving them all the time. So hey, yep, cleaning the cables, checking your cables and replacing them as necessary is always a good thing to do. Okay, now also on the outside of the case, we've got external vents. What do we clean those with?
Give them a wipe over with a lint-free cloth.
Yep, that's cool. And that's the five it's got here, but it asks, you know, can we think of anything more we have to do to our computer? I can think of a couple who can lead on this one.
I don't know whether it would be suitable for a computer, but I've found that there's a disk that you can clean optical drives with, that might be a good option for your CD-ROM drive.
You're right, and it's one that I hadn't got down here, Kate, because it's actually mentioned in the laptop chapter. I don't know why it isn't mentioned elsewhere, but yeah, that would work. It's the old optical cleaning kit. Clean your optical drive. That one is not mentioned here at all, so I'll have to put that one in. But there's two others that I was thinking of that haven't been mentioned yet.
Now, here again, I'm not certain this is what you're looking for, but scan disk and check disk for your hard drive.
Yeah, that comes a little bit later on. Actually, they have that under software. I'm not quite sure why. Probably because you use software program to do that. But that's a good mention. I was thinking of something needing isopropyl alcohol. What do you use isopropyl alcohol for?
Usually for things like cleaning off the thermal compound on your CPU. So I guess to clean any dust off things like inside the computer.
There's one other place you use it.
One, cleaning the dust from the power supply?
You wouldn't use isopropyl for that. You'd have as a soft cloth, but you use isopropyl for one other thing in the computer besides the CPU. What is it? It's used for cleaning RAM. Clean your RAM contacts. Yeah. So you clean your RAM because that gets dusty too. So if it's particularly dusty, take it out, clean the contacts with isopropyl, make sure it's nice and dry, put it back in. And of course the other thing is clean our monitor. I mean, it's not so much for us because we don't really use the things, but people kind of like to see through them, so I guess we better keep them clean. And that was the other thing that I had thought of. Anyone else got anything that I haven't thought of yet? Okay, that's our hardware cleaning routine. Okay, software. Now, software companies have policies around the kind of software which can be installed on systems, do they ever? If you've ever tried to get work somewhere and they squeak about putting JAWS or a magnification on the system because they don't know what it is, you'll know what I mean. Technicians who work on software maintenance in companies have to check security operating system updates, and they need to test them before they can be rolled out. Does anyone know why that might be?
Just in case they interfere with other programs that are being operated by the company?
Yeah, exactly. And you'd be surprised actually how often that happens, or maybe not so surprised, Microsoft being Microsoft, but hey, you know, that's what they have to do. They also have to review security updates and review software updates, you know, updates to the programs they're using. driver updates. Now we'll look into more what drivers do and are in the next chapter. But basically, it's important to update, to keep drivers updated. Yes, and the chat just said it has reiterated what you said, Kate, because of the conflicts with software. Okay, driver updates and updating virus definition files and scanning for viruses and spyware, removing unwanted programs, scanning the hard disk for errors, which is what you mentioned, John, the check disk, and of course the good old defragment.
Lost you, Kylie.
Oh, can anyone hear me now?
No, you've been fine, Kylie. You're okay. Maybe John's got some problems.
John, can you hear us? Ah, okay.
Okay, you are transmitting.
Right. I'll keep going then. Sorry about that, John. Now, is there any one thing that I haven't mentioned in all those things that you could be doing to maintain your software?
Did we go with the Windows update? I'm sorry, I missed you.
Yes, we did. Windows update is important, and I think that's what we were talking about earlier. Windows updates, operating system updates, they're called here, because we don't get to be really Windows-specific until the next chapter when we talk about operating systems themselves. So they talk about them as system updates, pretty much. So, yeah, they're the ones that have to get tested. I was thinking about registry cleaning, and Elise introduced you to CCleaner, which helps do that. So it's just something that isn't always thought of, but it's also important. Okay, so why are we doing all this? What's the point of doing preventive maintenance, anyone?
So that you can ensure the integrity of your systems and equipment. So hopefully you have less equipment failures and less downtimes.
Exactly. Yep, that's exactly the reason why they do it. And a good way to make sure that your preventive maintenance is carried out is to have a preventive maintenance plan. And you do this, sorry, I've lost my place. Plans will be a different in different environments. For instance, if you have got computers that are on a construction site, it's a dusty environment. And so you'll need more attention to cleaning and hardware, obviously, because you don't want dust getting in the computers. And I guess in some climates, that also applies for home use too. Like Elise's auntie Yvonne is in Darwin, and I guess more maintenance is needed there, say, than it would be in Melbourne, just because the environment is
correct.
Different.
Absolutely. We lost another board because it got full of, well, we suspect it's because everything got full of virtually dust, and then with the humidity turned to mud and a bit of guide dog hair as well, and next thing you know, I don't know what happened, whether the fan stopped going or the components overheated, but the motherboard eventually died anyway.
Yeah. Exactly. And of course, there's also high traffic networks like universities and schools. They might need more extra attention to scanning and removal of malicious software or unwanted files. So you take the routine maintenance tasks that must be performed on the computer equipment and the frequency of each task, so you work out those and you use this list to create a maintenance program. Now, let's look at some of the benefits of preventive maintenance. Who can give me some of them? They're in Figure 3 in this section, by the way. What are we actually doing when we perform preventive maintenance? I'll start with the first one. We increase data protection, and we use that by doing disk defrag, disk cleanup, whether it's with a Microsoft tool or with third party, registry cleaning and check disk. Okay, what's another one?
You also protect data by using things like spyware and stuff like that, and regularly making sure that those things are updated.
Yep, you do. Okay, what else are we doing when we're doing preventive maintenance? What's another benefit of doing this? And how do we do it?
One thing I believe is important is to have a complete data backup.
Yes, and we'll talk about that in a little while, because that's actually mentioned in the troubleshooting section, although it's not part of the troubleshooting, and we'll talk more about backups and how and why they're important and how you work legally around those when you're working for a company and you're troubleshooting, but we'll get to that. Extending the life of the components, how might your preventive maintenance plan do that? What steps that we've mentioned above might actually help you increase the life of your components?
Well, because if you've got clean, effectively working components, they're going to not suffer from as much wear because they won't have to work double time to try and do what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, exactly. So regular cleaning and maintenance. What about increasing equipment stability? What in your preventive maintenance plan would perform that role?
Well, what you mentioned about cleaning the contacts on the cards, and to be sure that your cables and connections are in, those are all elements to stability.
Yeah, I'm also thinking software updates and driver updates too, because sometimes if your program is becoming a bit wonky, driver update or a software update, something will add functionality and stop any instability that's there. So they also, I think, come into that category. Okay, decreasing repair costs. Again, what are we talking about here?
Well, if you keep your equipment properly cleaned and maintained, you won't run the risk of having more repairs than necessary, because the components will work to their fullest lifespan instead of to a reduced lifespan from not being looked after properly.
Yeah, and that goes to the next one on the list too, which is about decreasing the possibility of equipment failures. Now, what about increasing security? What would we do in our preventive maintenance plan to do that?
Update your security software.
Yeah, there's all kinds of other things you can do as well that are organisational practices, but we'll talk about those in the security chapter. So basically, what we talked about in this section of preventive maintenance is what to do in hardware and software, taking those tasks, looking at the frequency of what you need to, how often you need to do them, and forming a preventive maintenance plan. So I'm sure with that knowledge now, you could all go away, if I asked you to, and formulate a preventive maintenance plan for your own systems. Okay, now on to 4.2, troubleshooting.
I know that ever since my computer guy found out that Nerida's hair was all over my computer, I know that I now am a lot more careful about putting my computer on my lap when the dog's already been on my lap, and I'm a lot more careful about taking it to him every now and then and having him just blow the hair out of it.
Yep, good idea. Also, if you can avoid putting it directly on your lap, that's always another good thing, because you're actually covering the vents. But we'll talk about that in laptops in Chapter 6 and actually why that is. Because I think, Elise, was it your sister had a Cook laptop because she was using it in bed? Was that right?
That's it, yep. Karen decided that she would... got a problem, Houston. Oh, that's better. Still got the Grov key problem, have we? Can I be heard?
Yep, no trouble.
Okay, I'll just listen to Jaws here in the background. Yes, Karen did that. She was sitting there on MSN and Skype and stuff, and the Doona and everything sort of puckered up around the outlet vent for her laptop, and also probably the vents underneath that also stuck air in, and eventually it just got overheated and died, unfortunately.
Yeah, so it's best if you can possibly manage it to have your laptop on a hard surface rather than directly on your lap. I know they're called laptops, but they're really not supposed to be on a soft surface like your knee. Anyway,
this was with the Doona. She had it on the outside of the Doona, and it just sort of sat, nestled into the around the Doona, and bits of Doona and bedding came up around the computer and smothered it.
Very easy to do. Very easy to do. Yeah. Okay, has there anyone else got any more comments or questions before we move on to the troubleshooting section? That was a good review for us, wasn't it? Got all 4.2. We spent three chapters on it, so let's go on to something new. And any questions or comments before we move on? No answer was a stern reply, as my old friend Margaret Kelly used to say. She was a fellow typist in the typing pool where I worked years and years ago. Okay, troubleshooting. Now, your notes define it as thus. Troubleshooting is a systematic approach to locating the cause of a fault in a computer system. That's what it is. Of course, with fewer faults, there is less troubleshooting to do, thus saving an organization time and money. Of course, we've just been over that. A logical and systematic approach promotes problem-solving efficiency. Yes, it does, because it ensures you don't miss anything along the way. So easy to do. So you're not casting about aimlessly for a solution. Okay, now we're going to talk about customers here, and a customer, as far as Cisco is concerned, is anyone whose equipment you're trying to fix. So that person is from now on defined as a customer. And Cisco says there are six steps to the troubleshooting process. They are: 1, identify the problem; 2, establish a theory of probable causes; 3, determine an exact cause; 4, implement a solution; 5, verify solution and full system functionality; and 6, document findings. Now, you won't necessarily use all these in every situation, and you might not use them in the same order, but they are the steps that you'll need to learn, at least as far as exams and Cisco and all that stuff is concerned. Okay, are we all clear so far?
Crystal.
You're probably all asking, what the hell does all that mean? I did when I first read it, I've got to say. Never mind. Okay, but before we do any of that, we have to do something that John just talked about a little while, and that is what?
Back up data.
It is, Kate, yes. And it says here, although data protection is not one of the six troubleshooting steps, you must protect data before beginning any work on a customer's computer. If your work results in data loss for the customer, you or your company could be held liable. Some things like installing an operating system will put the data at risk, so take all precautions. And we, of course, protect the data by performing a data backup. And a data backup is defined as a copy of the data on a computer hard drive that is saved to independent media. Now, that's important because it's important to keep that media, whatever it is, a tape drive or a heap of DVDs, although heaven forbid that people are still doing that, or another hard drive, and that's kept away and off-site and usually, hopefully, in a secure location. In an organisation, backups are routinely or supposed to be routinely done on a daily, weekly and monthly basis. If you are unsure that a backup has been done, do not attempt any troubleshooting activities until you check with the customer. And from the customer, you need to know the date of the last backup, which is pretty self-explanatory, the contents of the backup. Okay, so maybe their whole system isn't backed up. You need to know exactly what's there. The data integrity of the backup. What does that mean, do you think?
Well, whether the backup contained all of the relevant folders that have their individual data within them.
I agree with Kate, and also a customer's backup could have corrupted files in it.
Yes, to both. That's what I was thinking. And, of course, there's no real way of knowing of whether what you've backed up can be successfully recovered. So that's always a bit of a... And I'm not quite sure how you could tell that, but if you've got a good backups and they're done regularly, then they should be good quality ones. Availability of all media for data restore. And for me, that's about where does the customer keep their backup? Is it in a safe place? Do they have enough media to restore? And we'll be talking a lot more about backups.
Well, actually, no, they keep it next to the microwave and so that it all got wiped by the microwave.
Oh, damn. Yes. Actually, you'd be surprised. I think people keep their backups, wouldn't you? Okay, so if the customer doesn't have a current backup and you're not able to create one yourself, you need to have the customer sign something called a liability release form. And that form should contain at least the following information: permission to work on the computer without a current backup available, a release from liability if data is lost or corrupted, a description of the work to be performed. Okay, so you need to make sure that your ass is covered, and just in case something goes wrong, because otherwise you could be held liable and so could your company. And of course, a goodbye business if that happens. So, are we all clear about backups?
For the customer, I see a real benefit in having the release of liability or however you worded it, Kylie, because they're going to be less willing to sign that and put themselves in the hot spot. They're going to be possibly asking you to perform a backup before you touch the system.
Yeah, and if you can't perform one for any reason, and what reasons might there be that you can't perform a backup?
Well,
hard drive failure?
Yes, Kate, sorry. John, you were saying?
Basically the same thing that Kate said.
Yes, although and then they may not have media to back up too. There might be all sorts of reasons that you just can't perform a backup before you do risky things to the computer. So in that instance, you really do need to make sure that you're covered. Okay, let's move on to 4.2.2 and the first of the troubleshooting steps, which Cisco says is identify the problem, of course. And what you need to do this is talk to the customer. You need as much info.
Oh, no, don't talk to the customer.
I know, isn't it painful?
Oh, dear.
You find me a computer tech who can talk to a customer. I don't know one.
Oh, we can talk to customers. We're computer techs, aren't we?
Meet us. And now you too, once you're qualified, you'll be a computer tech and you can talk to a customer.
I've got my consumer liaison background to help me actually communicate with people.
Bingo.
That's always handy, especially when you're looking at conversation etiquette, like things like ask direct questions to gather information. That's pretty obvious, isn't it? Don't use industry jargon.
I'm sure Kate's going to love Chapter 10.
Oh, yes. We'll have fun in Chapter 10, because it's all about communications, which you can read for help desk etiquette, basically.
Now, hey, this next... How do you get away with this one if you're 7 foot tall?
Talking down to customers? You have to sit down when you're being a tech for that person.
Yeah, I suppose you do. Next one is don't insult the customer. And I know how difficult that can be sometimes when you've got people who just either think they know absolutely everything or won't let you do the job that you're there for. Don't accuse the customer of causing the problem. Now, that one makes me laugh.
Well, who else caused the problem? It certainly wasn't the tech.
You'd be surprised how many people actually think the techs do cause a problem. I remember talking to an IT woman in a university years ago, and she kept saying to me how their professors were like a bunch of children. Every time they rang the IT department because of a problem, the first thing they would do is accuse the IT people of breaking their computers. I think it's extremely funny. But it can be very frustrating and really not help to do your job at all. But so don't accuse the customer. It always makes me giggle because she was very adamant on that point that it was usually her that's being accused of breaking the computer, not the other way around. So Kate, you're saying
they're professors. They know how to do everything. They don't break anything.
Of course not. Oh no. Anyway, to translate from the new system to the old, which this does here actually quite well, identify the problem means gather data from the customer. So basically that's what you're doing when you're in order to start to identify the problem. And you need information like the company name, the contact name, address, phone number, and the customer's name, of course. And you also need to know stuff about the computer, strangely enough. And you might find that the customer can't actually give you that. You might have to go to other people, but you do need this. Manufacturer and model, operating system information. What flavor of Windows is it? Because that's kind of important, especially now that people are using either XP, Vista, or Windows 7, all three are in use out there. The network environment, what does that mean? Anyone know? Network environment.
Whether they're using wireless or cabled network and whether they're actually within a big organisation or just in a home environment.
Well, actually the cable or DSL or wireless thing is about connection type, but yes, the other one is, you want to know a bit about the network. It's good to know how it's divided. How it's subnetted, as you'll learn to call it later on. Okay, connection type, yes, we've done. Okay, and you need a description of the problem. Now, there are two types of questions that you need to use to get information out of people, just as you would if you were interviewing, as I used to do for a living. And the first is an open-ended question. They used to obtain general information and they let the customer explain the details of the problem in their own words, and sometimes it takes all day. What are some examples of an open-ended question?
What were you doing when this happened?
Yep, any else?
No, that would be a close if you asked them if they could reproduce it.
Definitely a closed. What about what is the problem? What is the problem you've been experiencing? That's kind of an obvious one, I guess, isn't it?
Yes, and the starting with the customer, I guess you could do the extreme open-ended question, how are you today?
Yeah, I guess you
Not a good
could.
option.
Not if you wanted to st not still be there in 10 hours' time. Yeah, probably not. Okay. So, no, not if, yeah. But what about asking about what software's been installed recently? How might that help you to determine what the problem is?
Well, they might have installed something that's caused a conflict. So you could also check what the other question I would ask in relation to software is what programs you've been using lately that you might not have been using before.
Yeah, exactly. And what about the one you asked, Kate? What were you doing at the time? Why is that an important question?
Because that might be a way of finding out how to reproduce the problem, or is probably the quickest way to find out how to reproduce the problem is to go back and actually do what they were doing at the time.
Yeah, also, it's all about what was happening with the computer at the time. You know, perhaps the thing overheated, perhaps it was under load, all those sorts of things. Yeah. So, what about what hardware changes have been made? Because companies are always upgrading stuff, and they're supposed to be tested, but it doesn't always happen. So, why is it important to ask about any hardware changes?
Possibly they don't have the current drivers.
Drivers are actually software. They come with hardware components, but drivers are actually pieces of software.
There might be some conflict between different, for instance, if you've got a couple of different printers, there might be port conflicts and things like that.
Yeah, there could be. You're right there, Kate. Okay, so we're all clear on what an open-ended question is and what it's designed to do is to get information. But of course, if your customer starts to ramble on and on and on and on and on, which some of them will do, with other ones it'll be like drawing teeth and you've got to ask lots and lots and lots of tiny questions to get any response out of them. You need to move to the closed-ended questions, and this is so that you can get the most amount of info in the shortest possible time. What are some important closed-ended questions that we could ask the customer?
Oh, John asked the most important one before. Can you reproduce it?
Yeah, sometimes they may not be able to reproduce the problem if they're not quite sure how it happened, and that's often the case. Especially if they're not particularly knowledgeable, something will just happen, maybe a blue screen just came up and they have no idea how that happened, it just did. So perhaps they won't know how to do that, but it's an important question to ask. What about, has someone else been using your computer recently? Why is that important?
That's a good question because other people will change settings.
Exactly, and you'll get worksheets to do later on that have this very thing, oh, I was away sick and Pete was using my computer while I was away, and now I can't do this or that I used to be able to do. Red flag. Okay. What
Oh, that's
about
all right.
changing?
Where my sister worked, there was one lady who, not fantastic, I mean, she's 84, not fantastically computer savvy, and every time one of the other people worked on her machine, the settings all got changed, and she was totally lost because she could do things her way, and if anybody else mucked it up, then she couldn't do it. So every time she came into work, my sister had to go and refix all her settings for her.
Oh no. I'll be tearing my hair out if that was me. Just yeah, well hopefully, don't let someone else use your computer. That's the moral of the story there. And if they have to, then they have to use their own user account and not yours. And we can talk about why user accounts will take care of that problem, of course, in the next chapter when we talk about operating systems. Now the next question here is, have you changed your password recently? Actually, and you'd be surprised at how many people have trouble logging into their network because they leave the caps lock on and passwords are case sensitive. It's an incredibly common problem in corporate environments. What about knowing if they're logged into the network currently? Why is that important?
Would you repeat that, please?
Sometimes in organizations, different resources are available to different people, and so if they haven't logged in properly or if they have used the wrong login, they may not be entitled to the resources that they were entitled to normally.
Yes, and John, you were saying?
I didn't hear, I could not hear you when you asked the question that Kate just answered.
It's about logging. Why do you need to know whether someone can log into the network or not?
Okay. If they can't log into the network, they can't do probably what their job description says they should be doing.
Yeah, exactly. You might get a customer ring up and say, oh, I can't get my email, and the reason they can't get their email is because they're not logged in. Yeah, it's a surprisingly amount of time that happens. Now, Dina mentioned in the chat, just as we were having that little discussion, about something called deep freeze that helps prevent someone making changes to your computer. Dina, do you want to just write a little explanation of the chat into the chat, and I'll translate for the recording purposes? Okay, well, perhaps you can tell us about deep freeze in an email afterwards, because it seems like it's something we should know. It sounds like it might be. Does anyone else know about a program called deep freeze? E?
Can't sound familiar with it, no. What's it supposed to do? Back stuff up, is it?
Dina just said it's software that locks down the machine.
Okay, so that would guard against any changes being made if you want to protect a computer from someone else changing your settings. Yeah. Because what people tend to do in those environments often is they'll just turn on your computer, and if you've got your login things all stored in there, yep, it stops people changing settings. So that's good. Okay, now the last on this list, actually it was the second to last, but I turned it round because the next section talks more about it, is error messages. Why do you want to know what error messages people have received on their screen?
Well, it would normally be the error messages that would trigger you to move to where the problem is more quickly, because usually error messages are specific to specific things.
Yeah, they can be. Now, Dina's chat underneath said that it's used in universities, but I didn't get the second sentence of that. Did anyone else?
And internet cafes.
Oh, okay. Sounds good. All right. I might just Google that and see what it comes up, see what I can learn about it. Sounds good. And I guess, Dina, it's accessible, is it?
Apparently, yes.
Cool. Excellent. Yeah, I've got my chat on today, actually, so I can actually hear it, which makes a nice change. Oh, it's great having you in this class, Dina. You're always coming up with new stuff for us. Thank you very much for that. Yeah, I'll look at that. It's kind of neat. Okay, error messages. Wonderful error messages. And they pop up with monotonous regularity when something goes wrong. And the event viewer is a good place to look for the recent activity and errors. Now, to get there in Windows XP, you go Start, Control Panel, Administrative Tools, and it's under there. For Vista and Windows 7, you type Event Viewer into the search box and click on the Event Viewer in the results. Now, when the system...
Looking in the Event Viewer when you're ready, also highly condemned another board to death, Jackie and I discovered last year when we were servicing my auntie's machine.
You can what, sorry? I didn't hear the middle bit.
Oh, right. We used it to actually troubleshoot right down to certain things going on in the Event Viewer. Told us that the motherboard concerned on this computer that we were servicing for Evon had died, basically.
Yeah, you can get a lot of information about out of the Event Viewer. The notes say, when system, user or software errors occur on a computer, the Event Viewer is updated with information about the errors. The Event Viewer application records the following information about the problem: what problem occurred, so what the problem was, the date and time that it happened, the severity of the problem, and the source of the problem, so yeah. And it leaves an event ID number, and also which user was logged on when the problem happened. All good information. In versions later than Windows XP, yep.
Are we going to go into the Event Viewer with any in any detail? Because I went, after reading this the other day, went into the Event Viewer, and I tell you, I could not understand a single thing that it was telling me.
Yeah, we are going to. Actually, I'll get you all in a minute to go in there and see what you can tell me about what's happening in your systems. We'll just do it briefly, but we do cover it in better detail in the next chapter. There's even a worksheet where you have to actually go into there.
Yeah, thanks, Dina. I bet it does. Dina just said it comes with experience.
Comes with experience, yes. Yeah, it certainly does. But you'll get to mess around in the Event Viewer as part of subsequent assignments, I promise you. And actually in versions later than XP, this is not on the notes, this is something I found out, it's quite cool. You can actually create custom views and use them to more efficiently get in info about the events. So because the event viewer is divided up into sections, and in XP, if you wanted to find information about certain events that have occurred, you need to plow through each section to try to find out what that is. But in later versions, you know, in Vista and more in more sophistication and detail in Windows 7, you can actually export these saved custom views to other computers or administrators so that you can collect all the information you need on investigating one problem and have it together, which is kind of cool. Now, what system are we all using here? Yes, Kate.
So to take that one step further, you're saying that in Windows 7, you can customize it. Can you also customize that then to a particular user so that you're only looking the events that happen for a particular user so that then you could narrow down what you were looking for on a computer to the actual logged in user at the time?
I'm not sure, but I guess you could. The notes actually don't cover Windows 7. This is extra research I did because I wanted to see what the differences were between XP, Vista and Windows 7. As far as the event viewer is concerned, I knew there were differences, but I didn't know what they were. So I'm guessing you can. I'll look up an article for you about that and I'll post it in the discuss list. How does that sound?
Fantastic. Thank you.
Okay, I'll just have to make a note of myself to remember to do that. Article. Okay, that's got it. Okay, now although the event viewer is good for listing details about the error, you might need to look in other places to research the solution. And another place on the computer is something called the Device Manager, sometimes Mangler, if we're not feeling very kind to Windows. The Device Manager displays all of the devices that are configured on your computer, and they're done in a tree view. Okay, any device that the operating system determines to be acting incorrectly is flagged with an error icon, and this type of error is a yellow circle with an exclamation point. Now, unfortunately, JAWS won't read those. NVDA, I believe, will, but JAWS will not. It's something I've campaigned to my friends in good old FS for a while to fix, and they haven't as yet because most people who use JAWS aren't computer techs like we are.
The other thing I found is that if you actually go into the device, the first little box in general says this device is working properly, so you can usually tell by that anyway.
Back up for a second, Kate, in this list in Chapter 4, is at the bottom of that list, it says that the event viewer down at the bottom refers to the which user was logged in at the time of the problem.
And we can also use something called Spexy, I believe. Yes, I didn't refer to that one down the bottom of the list, John, because we had already covered it, and because, you know, seeing what user was logged on is only half what Kate was saying. We need to be able to limit the view per user, set the view per user. So, and I'm picking, you can do that with Windows 7. I don't think you can with Windows Vista, but you've got more flexibility in the event viewer with Windows 7 than you have in with Vista.
Okay. Excuse me if I took that out of context.
Hey, no, not a problem. Okay. So we're all confident that on our systems that we can get to our event viewer. Now, sometimes what happens is you don't go far enough in there. You've got to press enter a couple more times to actually get into there. Balark's a really good way of knowing what's on your what components there are anyway. And that's actually better than the Device Manager because it puts everything all in one place. You don't have to go ploughing through the tree view that you get into once you're in the Device Manager to open and close, you know, lifting and right arrowing all over the place. You get it in a nice HTM file, and I can add Balark to the list of things I need to email because sometimes we cover it in Chapter 2, but we ran out of time to do that, so I'll put it in this because it's a handy little utility to have. It even gives you the product key of your Windows disk and everything. And the information that it gives is growing all the time. It'll tell you what kind of motherboard you've got, what sort of hard drives, all kinds of stuff.
So these things that Dina's talking about, are these freeware things, or Are they things that you have to pay for? And how secure are they? I guess I get a little bit frightened sometimes about downloading things that they say are going to check your computer for this, that and the other thing. I get worried about the security of it.
Free for personal use, I think I heard there. Sorry, Dina, we have to translate your chats because they actually don't come through into the recording unless we do. And if people are listening out there later on, they're going to...
And Spexy is free as
well. Yeah. Okay, getting back to the error icons. Now, it's important to know these because if you're helping out a sighted customer, they might say, oh, it's got a yellow circle with an exclamation point beside it. And you have to know that... That means that something is acting incorrectly, that yellow exclamation mark with a circle. Now, if a device is disabled, it's flagged with a red circle and an X. So it's important to actually know these things if you're dealing with sighted customers, because they may not look in the next box to see the text, but they will see the flag and they'll be able to tell you what it is and you'll know what it represents. And a yellow question mark indicates that the hardware is not functioning properly because the system doesn't know which driver to install. And again, we'll get more into what drivers are in the next chapter. Now, in XP, you get to the device manager, or Mangler, by going start, control. Actually, I did remember seeing a program called Unknown Devices. Thanks, Dina. I'm not quite sure how well it works. I've never tested it, but yeah, it's certainly an alternative. It's always good to have alternatives to the Microsoft utilities, as we know. Okay, so to get to Device Manager in Windows XP, and this course is still Windows XP based for
Dina's used that and it works, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Okay, well, to get to find the Device Manager in XP, you go to the Start menu, Control Panel, and System, so keep pressing S until you get to System, and press the Device Manager button. And in Vista, you go Start, Control Panel, System, Advanced Settings, Device Manager. So there's one more step to go in Vista than there is in Windows. How do you get to it in Windows 7, E?
Type in Device Manager and up it comes.
Ah, right, that's easy. Thank goodness I've made a good search box.
It's a brilliant search box, and the good thing about it is that even if you just type device, you only have to go two or three arrows down and it'll come up with the correct thing that you want.
Oh, it's pretty idiot-proof then, isn't it, I guess, you know?
That's why I can use it.
Oh, no, you said it, Kate, not me. Okay, are we all clear on what the event viewer does and what the device mangler does so far?
The device manager saves me quite often because I had to install a special driver for my braille display and I had to go in there to find out what port it used before I could make JAWS find it.
Ah, okay. Well, you might find Balark very useful then because it puts all that stuff in one place. You don't have to go searching through and ploughing through menus to find it. Okay, beep sequences is the next on the list, and we all know about those. So what do we know about beep sequences, folks?
They tell you there's something wrong with the computer, such as memory failure, motherboard failure, or hardware failure, depending on how many beeps and what the BIOS manufacturer says each sequence of beeps does.
Exactly, and where do you research the beep sequences for the particular computer? There.
Thanks, Dina. The BIOS manufacturer would have all of the beep codes in with your motherboard specs and stuff.
Yep, so either the motherboard menu or the manufacturer's website. Now, so what was Dina saying?
Oh, he was just giving me some information.
Oh, okay. Now, so during post, if you hear one beep and the computer starts, that means what, people?
Echo K!
Yay! Excellent. Okay.
Can I ask a question about post?
Yep.
How do I tell on my laptop where post comes from? Like, do if you don't get any beep, which my laptop doesn't, is there a sort of a default time or something that you could sort of count to 5 seconds and then hit your BIOS key?
You might want to chime in here. I haven't done it, but I'd say as soon as you hear your hard drive spin up, that's when I'd be pressing my BIOS key.
That's all right. Dana just said no.
You use multiple boot, so how do you do it? Or how do you know that
people with no vision... So what was that, Kylie?
I was just asking how I could tell when to press the BIOS key, because my computer doesn't do a beep to tell me when the post is starting.
Right. Okay. Pretty much as soon as you turn it on, just keep going tick, tick, tick on the delete key or F1 or whatever it is. Just keep pressing it. Because usually what happens is when the machine's doing its memory test, that's when to hit the key to go into BIOS. But most machines these days are set to quick boot, so they don't usually test the memory like they used to. So it can vary. What you could try doing is get the help of a friendly neighbourhood sighted person to tell you, and then you'll get used to it. But yeah, just keep pressing the delete key or whichever key it is that does it, and eventually you'll wind up in there. But of course, being vision impaired or totally blind, you may not know that you're actually in there, and you'll probably need help getting back out again.
Oh yeah, that too, but I just was sort of curious about it.
Yeah, but it can vary depending, like my Triple E PC, I think it's F1 or F2. F1, I think it is, gets you into the BIOS. Most machines, the desktops I've been working on recently are, delete, so you have to know, and you have to know when to do it.
Okay, so it's worth trying various things. I mean, everyone has their own methods of doing it, but eventually you'll come upon one that works for you. There's no sort of one silver bullet, unfortunately, for these things. But it says here, if the computer boots and stops after post, look in the BIOS settings to determine where to find the problem. A device might not be detected or configured properly. Consult the motherboard manual again to make sure that the BIOS settings are accurate. Okay, moving on from beep sequences to LEDs. Now again, they're not important to us, but they are to our customer, because our customer is probably going to be sighted. And you'll need to ask the customer about these, because the activity lights on the computer and or on the internet connection, the router or the wireless access point, will tell you or may indicate that there's a problem. And again, these are manufacturer specific, but there are various generic rules of thumb. This course actually doesn't go into those. Yeah, like if you can get them.
Dana just said we could use color or light probes.
Yeah, the color ones will do. Light probes are harder to get in my experience. I haven't seen one available for a while.
A color probe for what?
To look on the activity lights on your computer or on the internet connections.
Oh, I'm coming to wherever you are, Dina. You can get combination units, according to Dina.
Okay, that's another thing we have to research, isn't it? That'd be good. Although I did hear on a demonstration of the Colorino a few years back that the light probe part of it wasn't very good. I hope they've improved that part of it, because the colour identifier itself was extremely good.
I've got a two-legged talking light probe and colour monitor, so I'm fine.
Oh yeah, well they're very handy to have two-legged talking ones, aren't they? With a pair of eyes to tell you what's going on. You'd be good. In the Discovery course, actually, it does cover what the lights, at least on a router or internet connection, mean in generic terms. And maybe what I can do or get E to do is look up those to see what they are, so you've got some generic idea of what things you might need to look for when things aren't going as they should. But are we all clear as mud so far?
Yep.
Bear in mind, we're still on the identify the problem section here. We haven't moved off it yet, which is a little bit about face, as I'll come to in a minute. But anyway, diagnostic tools are our next thing, and you can conduct research to determine which software is available to help diagnose and solve problems. And as the voice with a cell phone is a substitute for what, Dina? Oh yes, you could use the webcam. Actually, I did that. I got into trouble installing JAWS 12 on my big laptop, and so I phoned Elise on my on Skype using my netbook, which has a webcam, and I pointed it at the screen because I couldn't get Narrator to work properly either. So I pointed it at the screen of my big laptop, and she was able to help me out. And in the same way, our friend Jackie had inadvertently flashed her BIOS. Now, we won't go into that until quite a lot later in the course. It's basically updating the software in your BIOS, updating its version, adding it to... She didn't know what was happening, so she couldn't restart, so she had to get hold of Elise with the webcam.
She waited for me to come up. Yeah, it's funny that, because I wasn't due to come up for a little while later, because she has an appointment with a writer's group at that particular hour, and I thought, oh, I'll just give her a little bit longer to come up, and something told me, ring her up now, and she's online. I said, what are you not doing at writer's? And she goes, oh, my new triple EPC won't go. Oh, okay. So she'd already anticipated me coming up and had the older computer on standby, and she just aimed at the triple E, and I was saying, oh, you're in the BIOS, what have you been up to?
Someone also the other day on the discussion list was talking about using that on iPhones, you know, that face-to-face thing on iPhones between yourself and a sighted friend.
Look, Will and I, and you've probably seen Will Taylor around the discussion list, we always maintain no blindy should be without a webcam, because you can just Skype somebody up and get them to look.
Except if you're like me and only got one computer.
Oh, we've used it for all sorts of stuff. I've used it to look at things that Kim wants to show me, looking at colours of clothing and that sort of stuff. I was using it today to look for water damage in a flood, so there you go. It's amazing what...
Dina was suggesting a cell phone. You can use a cell phone camera too, I think, for the same...
Yeah, absolutely. I think for you, Kylie, I was helping you with, it was a login prompt or something one day?
It was loading JAWS. JAWS had hung. I had never had any JAWS installation problem in all the years I'd had it until I tried installing JAWS 12. So you had to get me out of that jam happened on my big computer, and you could, on my big laptop, and I could point the little netbook at it. And webcams and cameras of every sort are extremely handy. Okay, well, good luck with installing new hard drives there, Dina. That's cool. Let's know how you get on. Oh, well, we'll let you get on with it. Thank you for that. Okay. Oh, fabulous. Okay. We were talking about diagnostic tools, and it mentions hard drives here, actually. And we've already done this as part of the Chapter 2 worksheets, research diagnostic tools for a hard drive. And the manufacturers often make diagnostic tools with their components, so sometimes you might need to research whether they have a diagnostic program, piece of software for their component that you're troubleshooting. Okay, now that you've started to work on fixing the problem, you start documenting. Now, you need to document the invitation that you need to document the information obtained from the customer in the work order and in the repair journal. The work order is something that you give to a copy of to the customer or the company later on, so that everyone has a copy of what you've done and what you've done about it. Write down anything that you think might be important for you or another technician. Of course, that's self-explanatory. If someone else works on the computer later, you don't want them to have to guess. Yeah. Often the small details can lead to the solution of a difficult or complicated problem. Now, it's now time to verify the customer's description of the problem by gathering data from the computer. Actually, that's what I thought we were doing anyway, but they have put it in the first section instead of this one, which is 4.2.3, establish a theory of probable causes, which is the second step in the troubleshooting process. So now that the customer's told us what they've had for lunch and what the weather's been like and what's going on in the office, as well as what's wrong with their machine, hopefully, and all that, we can go and work with the computer and see what we come up with. Now, this establishing a theory, to establish a theory of probable causes, you need to try the obvious issues first. And as I said, you'd be really surprised about how often it's something tiny that you've overlooked. It says here,
like, let's plug it in and turn it on.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if you all recall, I don't know how true it is, but there was an email going around quite a few years ago now about a WordPerfect help desk call where the person called in and said they couldn't see, they couldn't actually do anything on WordPerfect, nothing was happening. And after all the questions, that was established that there was a power outage, so of course the computer wasn't working. The help desk call representative was sacked.
Oh, you spoiled it.
That they should pack the computer.
the joke is, the person goes off and goes, oh, I can't get anything on my computer. Oh, the screen's blank. And the help desk person goes and says to the client, oh, can you check to see if your cable's plugged in? The client comes back and goes, oh, I can't see nothing. Oh, why is that? Oh, there's a power outage. Bingo.
Yes, I do remember seeing that.
The rep was sacked for telling the person they were too stupid to own a computer.
That's stupid.
They were probably right.
Exactly, Kate.
They were probably right, yes, but you can't say that. You're not allowed to be mean to the customer.
Oh, you can't?
Yes.
Oh, is that why I'm unemployed?
For being diplomatic.
There you go. Yeah, I can't last.
Dina,
that
you're back!
Either.
Good to see you, Dina.
Yeah, it's sometimes my transmission seems to be coming through and other times not.
Oh, he's back. Welcome back. Yay.
Well, I used to work at government as a senior programmer, and we had a help desk, and a lady called in complaining that random characters were appearing on her document. And, the technician went and swapped out the keyboard, put a brand new keyboard. A few minutes later, she calls again and complains about the same thing. And eventually, he went and stood behind her and said, show me what is going on. And that's when he discovered that she was leaning forward. And every time she leant forward, she had her breast on the keyboard. And therefore, they were actually putting random characters on the document.
Oh, I've been down that road.
It's like the character I think I was helping one time on the help desk. And said, oh, all my print jobs are smeared. And they're coming out sort of funny and stretched at the ends near when it gets to the end of the page. And I'm going, well, as far as I know, other people use that printer on the network. This actually happened at Premier and Cabinet when I was there. And they're not reporting any problems. What's going on? Anyway, she insisted that there was a problem. And I said, what are you doing? I said, she goes, oh, I'm standing at the printer. I'm waiting for the page to come out. And I'll grab the page and I grab it out as it's coming out. And I said, well, there you go. You're pulling it too bloody quick.
Yeah, exactly. So, pulling it out before it has a chance to finish typing.
There you go. Silly idiot.
See, she shouldn't have owned a printer.
That's it.
Yeah, well, it says here that you, well, not that I would do this, I don't know who would actually initial a robot, create a list of the most common reasons why the error would occur, oh dear. Even though the customer may think there is a major problem, start with the obvious issues before moving to more complex diagnosis. List the easiest or most obvious causes at the top with the more complex causes at the bottom. Do any of you experienced troubleshooters actually do this?
No, well, I do it in about a tenth of a microsecond, you know. What is it they want us to do? Establish a probable cause and list what?
Establish a theory of probable causes, and you list the easiest theory at the top and the most complex one at the bottom, and then you go and test each cause in the next steps of the troubleshooting process. And it lists
no, I just jumble them up in the head. I don't know about them being easy or hard. Sometimes I go for the hardest one first, and I go, oh, God, I wish I'd tried the easiest problem first. Would have solved it in half the time.
Yeah, maybe. I think that's probably why it's trying to get you to think in a
Actually, I don't think I've ever seen a technician ever do that. You know, we had the famous one where people used to actually put down, when they came back to the department used to always log, when they had to log the call, they used to put down UFT. And after quite some time, I found out UFT stood for user finger trouble.
Ah.
Good one.
I could switch the F and the U around and change the finger to some other word and be done with it.
You're trying to say that the customers cause trouble? Never.
Of course not. Okay, now there's a list of obvious issues here. I'm not going to go through them because they're all really obvious to us. We've just had a big discussion on it. But the only one I'm just going to point out, because it's not ma- wasn't really made clear in the last chapter, is a non-bootable disk in the floppy drive. Now, we know...
I've got it right now.
Yes. We know in BIOS, if there's no bootable disk in the optical drive, which you often set as first in the boot order, it will just move on to the hard drive or any other. But if you've got a non-bootable disk in the floppy, it won't do a damn thing.
And the same for the USB.
Non-bootable media.
You know you can do that with the USBs too. Stick a non-bootable memory stick in your USB drive and set it to boot from USB first and see what happens.
Actually, I just have that now with the hard drive. I put in two brand spanking new hard drives in. So, of course, there was absolutely no operating system. So that's when it comes up with a message, no boot media. And that's when I actually installed the Windows from there.
Yep, I only saw that message 3 weeks ago when I put a new hard drive in my EEE.
Okay.
In fact, as I speak, I've still got the box lying open here, and I've done what all technicians tell you that you should not do, and you should close up the box and so on, and I've been working with the box plugged in and put in the drives and everything while the power is still plugged in.
You're a naughty, naughty boy.
Good on you. Oh, naughty, naughty, yes. Oh, well, it worked.
Oh, no, I thought SATA was hot swappable.
Well, he's still talking to us, so it must be all right.
SATA, so yes.
There you go.
We know things are hot swappable that aren't supposed to be.
Well, I tell you what. I've even finished. I've already installed. I've even installed Windows already, and I've got speech and everything up and running. So I can always install all the other software now.
Yes, go ahead, Kylie.
Yes, we know some things aren't can be hot swappable, even if they're not supposed to be, like Elise's netbook keyboard that Will changed on the fly while we were in the middle of a Skype call. And the only reason the Skype call went down is because he brushed the standby button on the way through. Otherwise,
yeah, I brushed the standby
perfect.
Button on the way through.
Oh, you didn't. We're just about was your fault.
Yeah, it was me. It was me, or else we could have punched the keyboard down into the holder and got the whole operation done without quitting the Skype call. That's not really meant to be hot swappable, so don't put that in your Cisco exam.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can get away with. Anyway, the testing the established theory of probable causes is all about going to the computer and testing your theories. Okay, the third step, 4.2.4, is determine an exact cause. And you determine exact cause by testing your theories of probable causes, obviously, one at a time, starting with the quickest and easiest. You ensure the device, got all the solutions to those list of obvious issues that we've all been discussing, and there's nothing here that is not perfectly self-explanatory in your notes. We've already discussed about cables and ensuring devices are powered on, ensuring there are no disks in the floppy drive, verify the boot order in the BIOS, and all that kind of thing. Now you can work out, once you've established your exact cause, you can work out how to implement the solution. And of course, if none of your theories work, you've got to start all over again and formulate new ones. In a company situation, you might have to escalate to a technician of the next level. And before you escalate, you need to document each test that you tried, even the ones that failed. That's really important, because the new technician doesn't want to waste their time going over steps that you've already taken. So section 4.2.4 is determine an exact cause, which is the third step in the Cisco troubleshooting process. 4.2.5 is implement the solution. Okay, now you've got a better idea of the problem, you can go ahead and solve it. Yay! Sometimes a simple problem is easily solved, and you can go straight to verifying full functionality. Now, we've discussed problems that ended up being simple to solve, but like the printers and various other things we just talked about. At other times, though, more research will be needed, and there are lots of places you can get more information if you need it, because you can't be expected to know everything. No one does. And especially if you're starting out in the troubleshooting game, you need to do a lot of research. So where are some places you could look to help you to solve problems?
Oh, in the manual?
Yeah, what kind of manuals might you look at?
Well, you would probably look in the device manuals, the motherboard manuals, and see whether the problem is listed in any of their troubleshooting sections.
Yeah, you could do that, or look on the manufacturer's website. It'd probably be quicker because they probably would have more up-to-date information than maybe the manual, depending on the age of your component. Yeah, Google is your friend, all right, someone just said in the chat. It definitely is.
Yeah, well, I actually never use the printed manual anyway. I always go to the internet because I find the printed manuals too difficult to... And the FAQs often on websites are a lot better than the manuals as well.
Okay, that's... Where else could... If you're working for a company, where else could you go to help you solve problems?
Other technicians, it says here, the news group.
Yeah, other technicians is actually a really good source of information because there will be colleagues that you're working with who are more experienced than you are, and they may have encountered this problem before, and they'll be able to look and say, oh, yeah, I know what that is. It's this, you know, or this is how you do that. So your colleagues can be incredibly, hopefully anyway, incredibly helpful. Not always. If you don't get on with them, maybe not, but they can be a really good source of information. If you're working in a help desk situation, there's also logs, because all your calls are logged with the problems and the various things. So looking at those can often help. Now, here's one that Elise loves to hate, and it's Internet Fora. And the reason I like it is because although you've got a lot of chaff, there is lots of wheat in there if you dig for it. It's amazing how many times I've done worksheets research and I found answers in Internet Fora because, yes, the chat and the flaming and everything else is really entertaining, but sometimes there are real little gems in there. So even though you might have to do a bit of digging, don't dismiss them. Anything else, people?
Kylie, did you say forums?
Yes, I said fora because that's actually their proper plural term.
Singular or forum, isn't it?
Yes, no? The singular is forum, yep.
Singular is forum, yeah. There's fora all over the net, too much of it.
It's like platypus and platypi.
Yeah, exactly.
See, Kylie's a little bit like me. She's a little bit older and does things like spell check and ensures that correct language is used.
Well, I try to, Kate. It's really
important. An ex-broadcaster wouldn't they? Ex-broadcaster and master researcher Kylie Maloney.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I guess, you know, as an ex-broadcaster, we used to get pronouncements, actually, from the presentation standards manager so that everybody pronounced words in exactly the same way. It was, you know, like having a house style. You write things in the same way and you pronounce words in the same way. So I don't know what else he did with his time, but he used to issue these edicts every so often on how we were supposed to pronounce certain words, you know, the names of foreign dignitaries and so forth. Yeah, so there's lots of places that you can look. You mentioned news groups, John. Now, I don't think there is many of those going these days. They're pretty old hat now, aren't they?
I mentioned it because it was on the list here.
Yeah, I haven't looked at one. Yeah, Usenet's still going. I don't know by how much, to be blunt, because I don't usually use it myself, but there are news readers. I was having a bit of a chuckle to myself when I was configuring Thunderbird this morning. Said, you know, I think there was a radio button or a checkbox. You want this program to be the default reader for news groups, etc. Gosh, I haven't looked at one of those for a long time.
No, I think Fora have pretty much replaced those now, haven't they, really?
Yes, there is mm-hmm. still services like Easy News and so on, which aggregates all these news feeds anyway.
Well, this is just it. We now have RSS, and people are blogging and how RSS feeds from not just the broadcasters and the media outlets, but just about every Johnny in their blog now has an RSS feed and can syndicate it all over the net, whatever they say.
Yeah, bloggers can also be a really good source. They're actually not mentioned here. I think they should probably be in place of news groups, really. They can be a really good source of information, and I think there is an exercise in Chapter 10 where you have to do all kinds of different sorts of research on a particular piece of equipment. But you'll come to that eventually, and blogs are included in that. Also, technical websites, which can be another really good source of information because they have neat articles about all sorts of stuff, which I sometimes read when I have nothing else to do or nothing else to occupy my mind, which is frequently. Let's not go there. Okay. Now that we have implemented the solution, we move on to the next The next step in the troubleshooting process is step number 5, which is 4.2.6 here in the notes, and it's verify solution and full system functionality, which means basically that after you've fixed the equipment, you need to check to make sure that everything works as it should and that you haven't broken anything on the way to the solution, which can sometimes happen.
Then run before the customer notices that you have buggered something up.
As an ideal, you want to try to get the customer to check that things are okay themselves. And it's got...
Only after I've left.
Head for the hills, Kate. Customer's after you.
Done. Damn right.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, you want to give them all your paperwork and all that kind of thing before you do that, and we'll get to those things. Some things you can do here is that you can test print from multiple applications. You can verify network connectivity, and we'll tell you how to do that in Chapter 8. All these different things will help you to verify that you've solved the problem and that the customer isn't going to phone you over and say, oh, you didn't fix it. Okay, so now that you have it verified, there's a good list of things that you can do to do that in your notes. I'm not going to run through them because they're all pretty self-explanatory as they are at the moment. There's nothing that's rocket science in there. Okay, the last step in the troubleshooting process is document your findings, and that means close with the customer. This involves giving the customer all the paperwork, a copy of the paperwork, and on that paperwork should be a description of the problem, the steps that you took to resolve the problem, including the steps that failed. That's really important because if the customer's worth their salt, they'll keep that paperwork and it will be available to the next technician who comes along or the next poor sap who's trying to help them with their equipment. The components are used in the repair and you need to discuss...
That's important because you've got to get paid for it.
It is, and the last thing that we have on this list that Cisco does not include is present your bill.
Absolutely, I said that when I was a student.
I reckon that should be at the top of the list.
You get the money first then trying to fix it.
And yeah, and as an instructor too, it was something that was drilled into us last year as well. Present your bill.
Oh, it's only because you got the priors like Jackie and I teach in you last year. That's what it was.
Exactly. But also you want to write down the steps you took to solve the problem in the technician's journal as well as in the work order, a copy of which also goes to the customer and the company. You need to put the same bits of information in your journal, any components used in the repair, the amount of time you spent to resolve the problem. Of course, it's important for billing purposes as well as everything else. And you are done. So the 6 steps of the troubleshooting process are, 1, identify that, well, firstly, the prologue to that, of course, is protect your data. Then you have, 1, identify the problem, and that's about talking to your customer, oh, heaven forbid. 2, establish a theory of probable causes, and so once you've talked to the customer, you need to gather data from the computer, try the obvious issues, look in the event viewer, the device, mangler, anything else, any other third-party programs that you might have at your disposal. And it says list all the, you know, do all the whole listing thing, which I don't know if technicians do, but it's important in case you're asked in an exam. By the way, there isn't an exam for this chapter. Hooray, hooray, I hear you say. No. The third step in the Cisco process is to determine an exact cause. So you do that by testing all your theories and making new ones if those don't work until you have found what the problem might be. The fourth is implement the solution, and to do that you may need to carry out research, and we've discussed all the places that you need that you could go to do that, and there are heaps and heaps and heaps of them. So no one can ever say that they can't find the answer to a problem, because there's just a wealth of information out there, even if you only peruse the net and do nothing else. It's just huge. Step 5 is verify system functionality.
Friend.
Yeah, it is. Google is your best friend. And verifying system functionality is about checking that everything's okay and that you haven't broken anything else while you've been doing it. And documenting your findings is the last one, and that involves making sure all your paperwork is correct and present, giving it to the customer along with your invoice. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is basically the lecture. Along with troubleshooting, we did preventive maintenance, and we talked about how to maintain hardware and software so that you have less downtime and less and fuel repair costs, sorry, not less repair costs, excuse me. And we talked about backing up. So that is the end of the lecture. Now, there are a few things I need to mention, but has anyone got any questions or comments before I do that?
Only if I'm allowed to ask you a question after you've done everything you want to do.
You can ask me now if you like. Does it make any difference?
I want to know, do Bluetooth keyboards stop working for no apparent reason?
It might depend on all sorts of things. Interference, whether they can find a proper channel, that kind of stuff. E?
Yeah, I was going to say, it sort of is off topic, and it isn't, is it? Because, I mean, so it's part of your troubleshooting thing. Go try your Bluetooth keyboard on another machine, or go and see if the Bluetooth stack is operational by seeing if you can talk to your mobile phone or other devices on that computer. That's the first part of the troubleshooting process. Go swap with known good components. Do they still have that in the Cisco stuff or not? I don't know. But that's what you generally do. You're going, all right, well, I've got a busted keyboard here. I'm going to try it out on another machine, or I've got a machine that's not receiving the Bluetooth, maybe I'll see if it'll still talk to my phone or something.
Yeah, it's one of those ones.
Components are still in there.
It's one of those ones where you plug the Bluetooth receiver thing into your USB and then it's meant to work off that. And what I've done is I've tried the USB in a couple of different places in the hub as well as directly into the machine. I've changed the batteries in the keyboard, and the computer says it's recognising the USB device, but the keyboard's not talking to the Bluetooth thingo, so I think it might be just stuffed.
Sounds like it to me, I'm afraid, Kate.
It will be. As long as you're convinced that the computer's recognising the Bluetooth dongle, you get the doo-doo as you plug it in, etc.
Yeah, I get that,
test it on another machine.
Yeah, well, I've got another machine here I can try it on.
There you go, see what result comes then.
That's why I'm using this crappy old USB keyboard today.
You'll find that when I said for your benefit earlier on, you'll find there are cases where, for instance, hard drives will not show up, and that's purely because the Windows has actually given it the same drive letter as another drive, and that's why it doesn't show up. But the device shows up as it's working properly without a problem. And all you have to do is just go into disk management and actually just reassign it a new letter, and you'll see it'll come up the next time.
Yeah, well, the times that the disk the whole USB thing will plug and play a device and give it the same number and not find it, so you've got to go and clean out the device manager. Show non-present devices or something is an environment variable one might put in there to fix the device manager up, but that's over and above what this lecture does.
Thank you for answering my question.
Not a problem, that's what we're here for. Okay, now I said there are no exams for this chapter, and Cisco doesn't actually offer any worksheets either, but Grace and I have found a worksheet on the Cisco site, which another lecturer put up, and we thought it was rather good. It's just a series of questions, and it now lives in Chapter 4 under Labs, under IT Essentials. So it's just an ordinary old Word file, so please go and download it and submit it as your only assignment to have to do for this chapter. All the answers are in the lecture and in this and especially in the notes. So it really is just a case of research as much as anything else. The answers are pretty much there in front of you. There's an activity about putting things in order in there, but it's a pretty breezy worksheet really, just as this whole chapter is. The other thing that you don't have to download, but I would strongly recommend that you do, is a troubleshooting supplement that Jackie and Elise ran last year for us. As I said, we have less time at the moment to do supplementaries. Now, you'll find that under ITE1, under old. And
well, get the URL up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Keep saying where it is, and I'll shove it in the chat.
In the old folder, you go to 4.0, and then audio, and then Elise and Jackie. And it's dated the 19th of March, 2010. And it's called a troubleshooting supplementary. So if you go into IT Essentials and go under old, because that's where the 4.0 stuff is stored, because 4.1 only came into being in CAVI last semester, So old will be anything before that, which this was. Under that will be IT 4.0, and then audio, and then Elise and Jackie. And it's dated the 19th of March 2010. Hopefully.
Yeah, he hasn't put it in audio 2010, so he's just got audio there because he hasn't updated it. So.
Yeah, it doesn't need actually audio 2010 because it's listed under old anyhow. So.
There you go. It's in the chat.
Okay. It's for those people who are not, who are listening later, that's how you find it. So if you do have trouble, then just email me or the discuss list or anywhere or instructors just to ask where it is. For those of us who are here today, it's in the chat. So I would really recommend that you listen to that. We had rather a lot of fun. And if we have time later on and if we can find a mutual time that we can all be here for, we might do something similar. But
yes, and if anyone's interested, the at that particular time it was actually a hard drive failure that we were diagnosing on Jackie's laptop. 7 months later, I went over and reefed out after waging significant war on the hard drive bracket that holds the hard drive in, got the hard drive out and changed it when I was in Phoenix. So there you go. Jackie now has a nice new hard drive in her computer and has gone off and installed Linux on there rather than Windows. So there you go.
Actually, I think you just spoiled it by saying that, because the whole idea of the supplement, as I remember, was to work out what on earth was wrong with this computer, and we didn't actually do that until sort of halfway through the session, but never mind. There we go. Oh. So you might enjoy listening to that. We have a short quiz, folks. It's only got 5 questions, but we have plenty of time to do it. So shall we proceed?
I'll bring it up.
Yep, I'll just grab it.
Now, I wanted to mention what it was because at the time we were not sure, well, we were still sure that it was, well, we were reasonably sure at the time it was the hard drive, but it could have also been the motherboard. So it wasn't really 100% we could swear our lives on what it was, even when we did that exercise. It's just that we've since been able to swap out the hard drive to know for sure. But it's an interesting way because we got the students to think it all through, and we got some interesting responses from some of the students. And I'm sure you'll, even if you do know what it is, because I think Kylie would have known what it was at the time, being friends of ours. So it's still interesting to go along and even listen to it after a year after we did it.
Yeah, and what you can actually hear is the fun we had, because we did. It was a great time. It was an extra.
Oh, I was listening to it this morning. It brought fantastic. Back good memories.
Okay, so if you all want to sit in your chat windows all ready for the quiz, have you got it up?
Yep, I've got it in front of me. Did you want me to do the credits or not? Or the other way around?
Yeah, if you could do the credits, that's fine. It's probably easier for me to read, is it, than you having to...
Yep, sure, thanks.
Okay, no problem. Question 1 is, which 3 common tasks are performed during preventive maintenance? Choose 3. So we'll do yes, no here because you've got 3 to choose and it gets a little bit iffy. Unless you want me to just run through them and you remember the letters. How do you feel about that, everybody?
Letters is okay by me.
All right.
Okay,
we'll try.
Me.
Okay, let's give it a go. So, preventive maintenance tasks. A, check and secure loose cables. B, update the RAM. C, clean the mouse and the keyboard. D, update the drivers. E, reinstall the operating system. F, install additional peripherals. Go now.
That's all right. I said I'd remember and I didn't.
Good one, Kate. Anyone else want to have a go?
Didn't
no, they're all forgotten.
You, Elise.
Okay, it's A, C, and D, not E, installing the operating system, nor is it F, installing additional peripherals, because you actually want to take away all the problems. So, you know, by having additional peripherals there, of course, would give more margin, more room for error, because there'd be more things to go wrong. So get as much junk off the system as you possibly can.
Okay, question 2 has only 2 things to choose, and I'll repeat each item so that you get it clear in your mind. That might help. In which 2 situations is it recommended to ask the customer to sign a liability release form before attempting any kind of repair? Choose 2. A. The technician needs to share the responsibility with the customer. That's A. The technician needs to share the responsibility with the customer. B. The information on the computer is critical. That's B. The information on the computer is critical. C. the technician is unable to back up the customer information. That's C. The technician is unable to back up the customer information. D. The information in the backup is confidential. That's D. The information in the backup is confidential. E. The customer is unable to provide a backup. That's E. The customer is unable to provide a backup. Go now. We have one answer. Any more? Any more than one? And there's two answers we're looking for here.
Yeah, you probably have to go back to yes and no's on these, but essentially,
it's C.
The person who now has a better memory than the first question actually got it right, C and E, which are, and I've got to look it up.
There was no backup, and there was...
hang on, I can read it. The first one, which is pretty important, the technician is unable to create a backup. And E, which is, again, another one of your right answers, Kate, the customer is unable to provide a backup. So what they're saying here is if you can't get a backup of that information or verify that there's a good enough backup, you make them sign a liability release form, because if something does happen to the data, they're going to come down on you like a ton of bricks, even if they couldn't provide you the means to back it up or wouldn't allow you access to back it up or they didn't have one themselves. They're still going to try and hang it on you if the data goes west. So make sure you get them to sign a release form in the event that you can't get a backup or you're not sure about the existing backup that the customer has.
Okay, question three is an easy one. That's just a one answer. Which type of question allows the customer to completely describe the problem? Is it A, closed-ended, B, open-ended, C, specific, or D, technical? Go now. And everyone, B is correct, aren't they?
B is the open-ended, I think. Yes, it is. There you go. You are correct, all you B people.
Hey, watch it.
Yeah, sorry.
Right. Okay, number four. There's only five of these, so we are cooking with gas, folks. Again, it's a single answer. Which Windows application can be used to obtain detailed information about errors that have occurred in the system? Is it A, BIOS settings, B, Device Manager, C, Event Viewer, D, Security Manager?
And people answering C, which is Event Viewer, you are correct.
Don't you say it again.
Oh, I thought very carefully now, do I say you see people or not? Oh, geez, you've got to be quick-witted to beat these Australians.
You do. Okay, here's a slightly trickier one, and it's the last question.
Especially those ones that come from Kyneton.
Oh, yeah, extremely. We gang up on you, Kate. Okay, a newly installed hard drive.
Out of suburb of Melbourne.
Dina said. A newly installed hard drive is not working. Oh dear. Where should the technician look to see if the drive is recognized by the system? That's the clue here. Where should the technician look to see if the drive is recognized by the system? Is it A, BIOS, B, boot sector, C, event viewer, or D, partition table?
People answering A for BIOS, you are correct.
There is so no fooling you people. Okay, that was a very short quiz, and we still have a lot of time left. So before I open it up to a final discussion, before we go, I'll just remind you, there is actually now a worksheet for this chapter. It's not a Cisco one, but it is there in Chapter 4 under the Labs folder in the IT Essentials section on the QCAT site. It's a series of simple questions. Please download and submit it. It won't take you more than an hour, absolute tops, I wouldn't think. It's really very easy. All the stuff that you need to find the answers is in the chapter notes.
And just the thing I'd like to reiterate what I said at the top of the lesson, of course, is that with that recording, I should have said it before when you were talking about it, the steps have slightly changed in the 4.0 curriculum to the 4.1 curriculum. So when Jackie and I go through them with students last year, they may sound different. So please don't
They will sound different. But at least Cisco is good enough to actually translate some of that in the new curriculum. So you will see some of the terms there when you look closer at what the actual six steps that they have outlined means. You'll see some of the old terminology there. So please do get, one is a recommendation, the supplement is a recommendation, but the worksheet is mandatory. There's no exam for this chapter, so that's at least one less thing that you have to worry about. But we thought that the information in the chapter was too important just to leave go by without anything at all, which is why we at least ask you to do something towards reinforcement there. But you will find that in subsequent chapters in your notes, the troubleshooting and preventative maintenance will be reinforced because there will be two extra sections added to the end of those notes. You get a preventive maintenance and a troubleshooting section at the end of every chapter from here on in. What fun! Okay, has anyone got any questions or comments or things they want to discuss CAVI related at all while we are still here? You all want to go off early for a beer, I know.
It's a little bit early for a beer. It's not even 2 o'clock yet.
Oh, and over here it's not. It's nearly 4 o'clock.
It's almost 7 o'clock at night here, so it is time for a beer.
It's also probably time for dinner, John.
As soon as my wife and daughter get back, that'll be number 2 on the menu.
Oh, I will have had 2 beers before they got back.
Well, you're an extremely good bunch. It's great working with you. It's, you know, we've breezed through this chapter, but it's mostly pretty self-explanatory. You know, you've discussed what needs to happen. You're aware of how to and not to talk to customers. And all you really need to do is learn the troubleshooting steps as they occur. At least as well as to pass the exams, how they apply in practice is going to be about how your experience, what happens, you know, as your experience grows. So, yeah, that is the troubleshooting chapter, people. Thank you so very much for coming. It's a pleasure to have you with me on this journey. You're great people, and I look forward to talking to you during the week, either by Skype or email, and seeing you next week when we start on Chapter 5, which is a very different kettle of fish. We really ramp up the gears here then, because it's going to take at least 2 weeks' worth of lecture. We may get it done in 2, but we may need 3. We'll just see how we go there, but it is a big chapter, so maybe you might want to do a bit of advanced reading since there's so little to do this week. But anyway, it's been great having you along, and I shall look forward to talking to you individually through the week. Goodbye for now.